Got
There
it.
we go.
Got it.
Cool.
All right. We'll do our intro.
That looks like urine.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. This is episode 76. And tonight we have the OG of American regenerative agriculture, Joel Saladin himself. Joel, welcome to the Fearless Podcast. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. It's a real honor.
And the urine you saw me drinking is electrolytes. So I'm not one of these people
Hippies.
like Bear Grylls that drinks their own urine. Oh, that is great. Hey, Joel, I wanted to have you on for two reasons. You're a very good friend of yours, John Moody, came on the podcast. And so I wanted to get a chance to talk about the Rogue Food Conference y'all are having in Dallas. And secondarily, maybe we could start out by you describe yourself as a Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. So maybe for those that aren't aware of who you are, maybe you could kind of break that down for us as an intro.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. And yeah, so I developed this moniker many years ago, actually, because I was so tired of being assumed that I was some liberal earth muffin tree hugger, commie pinko, because I was a quote unquote organic farmer. And so I could either be frustrated by it or I could have fun with it. And I decided to have fun with it. And so I made my own moniker, a Christian. I am a Christian, a libertarian. I'm a small governmenter. I don't think you can have small business and big government. The two are mutually exclusive. Let's see what I've got. Christian, libertarian, environmentalist. So I do care what happens to the environment, and I think it's all God's stuff. It's not my stuff, and I'm not sure he likes. He would be happy with a dead zone the size of Rhode Island in the Gulf of Mexico. That we've created. And then, I mean, stuff, I'd say somebody destroyed my backpack, if it were mine. And then capitalists, yes, I think that capital is important. I'm not opposed to Wall Street. I'm not opposed, to corporations. I'm not opposed to business. And I think, a profitable business is a good thing. And so I'm a capitalist and then a lunatic. I've been called to my face by numerous times, a Typhoid Mary, a bioterrorist, a starvation advocate, because we all know that unless we use chemicals, half the world's going to starve. And so there again,
Absolutely.
I decided, well, I could either be frustrated about this and just let it get at me, or I can just turn it around and have fun with it. So I decided I'll embrace it. All right, yeah, I am crazy. Of course I'm crazy. And lunatic seemed like a pretty good word to go with it. And so I took that, and that has become a true That's one of the best decisions I ever made. I mean, it's become a real handle. If you Google lunatic farmer, there is not another one. I'm not defending this from any other, intellectual property on the planet. I don't have to register it. I don't have to do anything. I'm the only lunatic farmer in the world, so it's kind of cool to be that exclusive.
That's awesome.
Perfected your branding.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. That's good. I don't have a bunch of other people knocking at the door trying to call themselves a lunatic farmer. So many people, I mean, friends, good friends, it said, man, that's pretty risky. I mean, a lunatic farmer, I mean, nobody will believe you. You'll lose your credibility. Nobody will, listen to you at all. And in fact, it's done exactly the opposite. It's opened all sorts of wonderful doors and opportunities. Everybody wants to hear the lunatic farmer, so yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Well, I was thinking maybe we could unpack one of the things I wanted to talk about is the bureaucratic deep capture of our food resources and supply chain. I believe that your Rogue Food Conference is kind of like in light of this with, I know it's going to be focusing on the RFID cattle tracking shenanigans, but I thought maybe we could delve and dive into this bureaucratic deep capture of how they're trying to systematically eradicate our food system, just like we're seeing in Europe with the UK and registering your chickens and all that good stuff.
Well, what we've got is a situation where we have an American populace right now, unfortunately, that has drunk the Kool-Aid that says the only safe food is government sanctioned food. In other words, if there's not a government stamp or a bureaucrat to sign off on it, it's not safe. In fact, I was a couple of years ago, I was speaking at a university in California, and during Q&A, I don't know, just things kind of one thing led to another, and I just whatever, the spirit moved, and I thought, I'm going to ask a question. So I had this, lecture hall of, I don't know, 200 or 300 students in there. And so I said, let me ask you a question. I said, how many of you think that in order to eat a carrot out of your own garden, a government agent should put a stamp of approval on that carrot before you can eat it, to ensure that it's safe so you don't eat a bad carrot? And guys, one third of the hands went up. Now
Wow.
it wasn't half, all right, but a third of the hands went up that a bureaucrat should sign off on your eating a carrot of your own raising and producing in your own garden. That's
Wow.
where our country has come at this point to to wanting government whatever approval, licensing, compliance, oversight. Let's just say oversight. That's the word to use. We need oversight. We need oversight. Well, whenever there's government oversight, that oversight is going to be it is going to be coming from a certain orthodox narrative. And that orthodox narrative is not going to be, home kitchen charcuterie, or backyard butchered pigs, or homemade pot pie. It's going to come from a narrative that everything needs to be licensed and signed off on. And the problem is that all food regulations are size prejudicial. In other words, it's easier to comply if you're big than if you're small. And I suggest that any regulation that it's easier to comply if you're big than if you're small is an unfair regulation. And that's where we are right now. I mean, if I wanted to, I mean, like, I mean, I can give you a story. We had a young lady with us a couple of years ago that wanted to start making. I've always wanted to offer chicken pot pies to our customers. They want, our customers want them. Our joke around here is what our customers really want is edible hot pockets. Hot pockets aren't edible. They might be a shock to some people, but they're not actually not edible. And our customers actually want, GMO free, chemical free. A hot pocket. Well, the closest thing to come is like a chicken pot pie. All right. And I love chicken pot pie. So this young lady, she was a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. She's very credentialed. And so she comes down and I'm going to start making chicken pot pies. So what do I got to do? Well, I've got to have an inspected kitchen. So the health department comes out, and well, where's your bathroom? Well, we've got a nice kitchen, and it's 100 yards from four bathrooms. Our house has two. Mom's house has two. Oh, no. It's got to have a bathroom, hook as part of the building. So why? If the cook is happy to walk 100 yards to the bathroom, why do you need a bathroom, out there? It's got to be. Okay, so how about we put a composting toilet? No, it has to be water-based, licensed, septic field, everything. So now suddenly, to sell one chicken pot pie, you have to have a $50,000 septic field, drainage field, and bathroom added on.
Mm.
So she finally gave up on that, and she went to town and found a church that had an inspected kitchen as part of the church. Okay, we'll make it in there. So, you know, she has meets with everybody, and she walks through all the hoops, checks all the boxes, and finally, you know, and in fact, you know, when they were here, I asked them, I said, "No, wait a minute. Why do we have to have a bathroom to prepare food to feed it? Food trucks don't do that. Food trucks don't have bathrooms." He said, "Yeah, that's a loophole we're trying to close. We're trying to work on that." Well, oh my goodness. And so then I said, "Oh no, but wait a minute, let me get this right. Are you telling me?" He said, "So yeah, you're right. You can prepare food out of a food truck and sell it." I said, "Okay, so you mean if we took this kitchen that we have, that you said is okay, except for the bathroom, if we took that kitchen and mounted it on a truck chassis, so it's now on a truck chassis, then you know we wouldn't need a bathroom." He said, "That's exactly right." I said, "Wait a minute, can you tell me why any of this makes sense?" And then he said, "But the problem is, if you put it on a chassis, then you can't sell the food that's produced in that off site. In other words, we were wanting to make pot pies, freeze them, and it, you know, it would go as a heat and eat, ready to eat meal, you know, with our regular, you know, T-bone steaks and chicken and all the stuff that we normally do, eggs. And so, you know, we'd fix them, we'd freeze them, and then they'd go as a frozen heat and eat ready to product." And he said, "Yeah, you could do the food truck route, but then you can't sell any of that off site. It can only be sold on site." So they've got you coming and going. So anyway, she goes to this church and finds this kitchen and, you know, starts working through this. The congregation is thrilled to have a finance, you know, a rent coming in from the kitchen, because they're a, you know, old mainline church. You know, it's a massive church with about 10 people still going, and they're all in their 70s.
Yeah.
And so they're thrilled about it. Anyway, comes up to the final day, the final, you know, stamp of approval. The guy walks in. He's been working with her, you know, for almost of a year of trying to work through all this. And he comes in, he says, "You know, I think I'm the wrong department to give this license. It needs to be this agency over here." And it just killed her. It just, you know, she said, "I'm done. I can't do this anymore."
Yep.
And she left. And, and our customers don't get chicken pot pies. We can't make them. We can't sell them. Somebody lost an entrepreneurial opportunity, and there it is. And that story can be repeated 1,000 times a week in the great liberty-minded country of modern America.
And that's by design, right? To you're mentioning about how the largest, you know, the largeness, like you can do all the things if you're huge, right? Because you can financially do that. And then everybody wants to know why our food supply chain is monolithic, you know, where you have two companies that process like 90% of the world's pigs, and then you have six beef processors, and most of them are international. And it's because of this bureaucratic, technocratic, pay to play payola, like this, like real world mafiosa. You know, there's a podcast called The Meat Mafia, and there definitely is a food mafia, and it is being, it's being facilitated by this bureaucracy, that the sole purpose of that bureaucracy is so that homesteads, mom and pops, up and coming teenagers, and those that want to experiment in this capitalistic market are prevented from entry. And the transnational mega corporations that have transferred 99.8% of the wealth in the world into their own market share are just left to run roughshod, extract all the resources, and leave us making, I don't know, basic universal income predicated upon their metadata.
So if I may, I'm going to dare to take a little different tack than what you've just taken there, because I think it puts the onus, or the whatever, the agenda, if you will, on the wrong person. So I've talked to, over my career, I've done numerous congressional hearings, State Department hearings, different things. I've talked to the people, to the regulator, to the bureaucrats. All right, these evil, terrible bureaucrats, and I do not believe that they have a conspiracy in mind. Let me tell you about a conversation I had, for example, with our head of meeting our Department of Agriculture, our Virginia Department of Agriculture. So I was down at Virginia testifying before our General Assembly on cottage food laws, and you know, a little bit of, well, to open it up a little bit so that neighbors could sell to neighbors, you know, neighbor to neighbor, so we could have some food commerce neighbor to neighbor. And so he caught me during a break, very nice guy, caught me during a break. He said, "Joel," he said, "we can't give people food choice." He said, "If we let people choose their food, we couldn't build hospitals fast enough for all the sick people getting bad food." And he looked at me and he said, "You've got to understand, I am personally responsible for every morsel of food that enters the mouth of every citizen of the Commonwealth of Virginia." Now I'm thinking to myself, you're either the biggest fool in the world for even thinking that's possible, or number two, if you really believe that, then there's no way you could ever sleep at night because of the burden of that responsibility. So, you know, it's one or the other. But my point is that the bureaucracy lives in a world of cheating, intrigue, and corporate, what can we get by with? And so the if you're looking for, you know, a perpetrator, you know, why have we gotten this way? It's the consumer. It's the consumer who has demanded the government oversight. Mm-hmm. And so they've shot themselves in the foot. I mean, mm-hmm. think about it. In 1906, Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle. And at that time, seven large companies controlled half of America's meat supply. Seven mm-hmm. controlled half. And there was no chicken. There was no Tyson. There was no big chicken company. All the chickens up until 1940. Get this: up until 1940, the average flock of chickens in the United States of layers was 100 or less.
Up until
1940. Okay,
that's crazy.
So all of this you know, these factory farm things are a very recent invention. They haven't been around that long. Mm-hmm. And so we go back to 1906, Upton Sinclair writes The Jungle and accuses the seven big meat packers of an oligarchy because they control half the nation's food supply. So, you know, within 6 months, what people don't understand is that within 6 months of that book being written, those seven companies lost half of their sales, and Americans flocked to backyard butchers, neighbors, local food systems. It was the biggest return to local food systems and neighborhood, you know, community slaughterhouses and stuff that the country had ever seen. And so these big seven companies, you know, Swift and Armour and stuff, they went to Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president at the time. I call him Teddy Roosevelt-ski. He was actually a socialist. And they went to Teddy and they said, "Look, we've got to have protection here. We're going to go bankrupt. People aren't buying. Mm-hmm. We need a government program to give us credibility with the consumers again." So he was more than obliging and established the Food Safety Inspection Service, FSIS, mm-hmm. by in 1908. That came in. So here we are, a little over a century after the government began inspecting meat and poultry, and at that time, we as a nation considered seven big players controlling half of the nation's meat supply as being, you know, like un-American. Okay, and today, as you said, TD, we've got four controlling 85%. And people have the audacity to call that the free market. No, we haven't had a free market for a very, very long time. So as soon as you have government oversight, what you have is a prejudice against newcomers. You have prejudice against competition, and you have compliance requirements that are so onerous that startups, that entrepreneurs wanting to birth embryonic startups can't birth them because the embryo has to be too big to be birthed. The reason an oak tree starts from an acorn and a human starts from a little baby is because if you birth these things very big, the birth doesn't work. And so what's interesting, what people don't understand is that the big outfits today, Frank Perdue, Don Tyson, Bob Evans of Bob Evans Restaurants, all of these great big brand names that exist today, all started in the 30s and 40s on the tailgate of a pickup truck with some local, you know, aggressive entrepreneur that said, "Hey man, you know, I can build this business," and was, you know, developed a better network, a better distribution, better product, mm-hmm. better, you know, marketing, and built a brand. And the problem is that if we don't preserve the same freedom for competitors today to start up from the tailgate of a pickup truck, we doom today's consumers to the innovation that always happens from the tailgate of a pickup truck. And we ensure the continued concentration and centralization of the big players who got in early enough to enjoy the ride of protection through the government bureaucracy. And so this thing started with you know, consumers exercising their market capacity, the big corporations asking for relief, but then consumers have been duped into this idea that the government oversight is some sort of non-political, empirical, objective test, when actually mm-hmm. it is very much dominated and controlled by a fraternity of corporate bureaucratic collusion that conspires under the pretense and the push of consumer advocacy like Ralph Nader and those kind mm-hmm. of people that are paranoid. So the industrial food system moved into an opaque place. You know, 400 years ago, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker were embedded in the village. Everybody knew who the good ones were, who the frauds were. They lived in town. They went to church mm-hmm. in town. They lived above their stores. The good ones succeeded, and the bad ones got run out of, you know, couldn't succeed in business. Well, in the industrial food system, what's happened is that these businesses have gotten so big they put up razor wire, no trespassing signs, guard posts, and people when people can't see behind the fence, they become fearful. What are they doing behind mm-hmm. that fence? And so they ask for government. They're looking for a bigger bully. Well, we need a bigger bully than mm-hmm. those corporations. And so they look to the federal government as the bigger bully than the corporations. But it's all being created by fear of the unknown. And when you don't know what's going on behind the fences, that creates fear. Fear creates a desperate desire for somebody to come in and police it all. And so that's the kind of political climate and context that we're dealing with now. And so, that's why I'm on a bit of a tear to help people to understand we've got exactly the system we asked for. And if we want freedom, we've got to ask for freedom, and we've got to demand freedom.
Hmm. Yeah. And one of the ways you do that is with your monetary choices. Yes. And another way that you do that is to participate directly. You know, we were part of that homestead tsunami you talk about. We were probably maybe the initial first shockwave in like 2010. We got some chickens and goats. And then in 14, we strategically relocated to Texas. And now we have a small herd of cows And we've been cured of a lot of our other animal fixations. And
yes.
We've determined that the cow is the most passive input free nutrient dense
Incredible animal.
creation of God known
Yeah.
to man.
Yeah.
And so we're fascinated with it. And we've been able to scale that enough to sell here locally. And
Yep.
one, we know what's in our food because we're feeding our cows. We don't spray our fields or anything like that. And then
Right.
we create a little bit of abundance to share with our community. And not everybody has the grass to do that and different things, but just starting, I mean, 10 years ago, we never would have imagined that we would be raising cows. We certainly wouldn't have ever
Yeah.
dreamed that we'd be selling our own beef here locally, but it's just doing like that 1% every day, that
Yeah.
making that tiny financial decision and just putting in a little extra effort. Maybe it's a 50 feet of fence, you know, and as you continue to do that, it's just that little bit of effort every day. And 10 years later, you kind of look back and it's a miracle, you know, it's like the
It
push
really
up.
is.
You know,
Yeah.
you can't do push-ups, you're overweight. You fall on the floor and you do a push-up, and then you do a push-up every day, and then by the end of the week, maybe you can do two push-ups. You know, by the end of the month, you might be able to do 100 push-ups, and it's that same concept of just these small daily decisions that you make that can achieve greatness. And that's kind of like the message that we want to present and show is like everybody can do this in their own way. One, you have to be cognizant of what the issues are. You have to be cognizant that the our mainstream food supply is poisoned either by design or by default, you know, just by because of scientism, right? It's just like you were saying, people desire this sanitized version of reality. So if we apply the scientism, there's certainly some type of genetically modified or some type of sanitized with some chemical spray, or you know, maybe it's some type of forever chemical we can spray on something to make it shelf stable
Well, it's the
for.
same reason why people get grossed out when they hear that, people love to drink raw milk, and they're like,
Yeah,
they get all
exactly.
skeeved out. And I'm like, they want to pasteurize it and do all this disgusting
There was
stuff to
quite a
it.
hubbub on Twitter a
Yeah.
couple weeks ago from Matt Walsh, like jaw jacking long about how
He still talks about
terrible raw
that.
milk is.
He still talks about that. Man, it's so weird.
Well, most of the industrial or processing that goes into food, we now have this new term, ultra processed. But most of the manipulation of food in the industrial food sector has one, well, they have two aims. I love your term there on scientism in food. They know our body, they know our taste, and they know what makes us addicts, addicts to sugar, salt,
Very
certain
true.
kinds of things. Yeah. And so
Yep.
manipulated. I mean, that's what they do in New Jersey. That's what, what they have all these tests and things to mouthfeel and all, they have mechanical mouths, robotic mouths, to get tackiness and all these kind of, in addition to flavors and all that stuff. So the first thing is to try to make us never always wanting another taco chip, another Dorito, another whatever. All right. So it's never satiated. It's always, craving. So
More.
the scientists know how to stimulate cravings. All right. So that's the first goal. The second goal then is shelf life, stability. In other words, how long can this last on the shelf? Because the longer it can last on the shelf, the more you can push your sell-by date down, the less perishable it is. The easier it is to control your inventory, the longer your lag time is. Well, the problem is that our digestive system, those several quadrillion beings in our belly, they actually don't want sterile, shelf stable things. They want stuff that will rot, because basically we have a NASCAR compost pile in our innards, and it's taking this stuff and digesting it very, very rapidly. And so you can take Velveeta cheese and squeeze it out on a table, and you can walk away from it for a year, and it doesn't do anything. I mean, it just sits there, but if you take real cheese, put on a table, in 2 days it gets fuzzy, and in a week it sprouts legs and walks off the table. And so if something won't rot, it won't decompose. If it won't decompose, it won't go in. It won't work in your digestive system. One of the most fun little exercises I ever saw. I was out speaking at a school outfit in California. This was a public school, and it was a middle school complex, and they took me over, and all these several schools had all worked together to get a little 3-acre farm. And they had these two women run this 3-acre farm, and they incorporated the farm into science and English and history. It was just wonderful how they'd incorporated this farm. And so every week the students had half a day out here at the farm, under various and sundry academic things. And one of the things that these ladies did, they got a big box. It was about 8 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. It looked like a oversized coffin, a coffin for Frankenstein or something, or maybe Shaquille O'Neal. Anyway, this great big box, and it was earth. They made a worm bed in it, a worm bed, and so the kids were fascinated by the worms. And so they one of their homework assignments was, when they come next week, bring food items. So the next week, the kids brought, Snickers bars, Cheerios, gummy worms, the food that you would expect a bunch of, middle schoolers to bring. And so they put it in a worm bed. And then the two farm ladies, they brought, some meat, an orange, an apple, potato. They put it in the other end of the box. A week later, the students come, they go charging up the hill, they open up the box, and they pull out their Twizzlers and their gummy bears and their Cheerios and stuff, nothing touched. They go to the other side, and the orange is eaten, the apple's eaten, the meat's eaten, it's all gone, and it's not there. The object lesson, of course, the teachers then looked at the students and said, "Well, why would you want to eat something even worms won't eat?" And it was a poignant lesson. And if that kind of stipulation, I mean, if that's what the government demanded, it's got to be, it worms have to love it. If your food, if worms don't love your food, it can't be on America's grocery shelves. I mean, can you imagine that kind of a ruling? Suddenly there wouldn't be ultra pasteurized milk. There'd be only raw milk. There wouldn't be a bunch of manipulated stuff. It would be just unprocessed material. So that's just a wonderful story. And I thought, man, how creative of those two teachers to design something like that was so powerful for the students.
It's very,
Yeah, and
very
what's
smart.
interesting about that is if you take that out like one step further, as far as processed and unprocessed, the only way to facilitate that type of supply chain, as far as processing your product the least, would be facilitated exclusively by decentralization. Your raw dairy couldn't be, if you're in Texas, your raw dairy couldn't be in California. I mean, I realize there's dry ice and different things like that, but that would almost facilitate decentralization because your proximity to your product would have to be within a non-perishable range, which would then re actually reinvigorate our food system, our food supply. It would make smaller concerns obviously more profitable because it would drive business to them. And And from a libertarian perspective, we do know, and from an Austrian economist perspective, decentralization allows the capitalistic market to actually perform and provide services efficiently.
That's exactly right. And I would suggest too that it is people like us on the what I call the lunatic fringe. That's where innovation happens. And when you have an overarching, overreaching, bureaucratic extortion like we have in the food system, it prohibits true innovation from happening. I'll give you a story. Back many years ago, the state came in and tried to shut us down. They said we couldn't butcher chickens in an open air facility and sell them. It was illegal. The chickens, if chickens contacted open air, they were inherently adulterated and inedible. And I guess these guys never go to a picnic. I don't know what, but anyway, we you know th that that was their position. And
What if you were 6 feet away from him? Because we've learned recently that there's a magical distance that resolves
That's
those
right.
issues.
There's a patina. My patina, gentlemen, is okay. So anyway, they come in and they tried to shut us down, and said that the chicken was inherently adulterated and unsanitary, and because we had an open air facility. Well, fortunately, just before all this big brouhaha developed for us, we had had a some university students nearby had taken an interest in what we were doing, and they came and got simple samples of our chicken and went to the store and bought chicken and sent them to a lab to culture for bacterial colonies. And we had the report. I showed it to the inspectors. I said, look at this. So it came back, took about 2 weeks for the cultures to come back, came back. The store-bought chicken averaged 3,600 colony-forming units of bacteria per milliliter, so 3,600. Ours averaged 133. Now the store chickens they've been bathed in up to 40 chlorine baths, antimicrobial, all this had, of course, the U.S. DEA stamp on it, approved. Ours, we don't use anything toxic. All we use is soap and water. We don't use any antimicrobials, nothing. And ours was 133 compared to 3,600, 25 times cleaner. And I asked these, I said, if do you really want clean food? I mean, if they were really just interested in clean food, they would have quickly called Richmond and said, hey, stop all the processing plants right now. Let's put a moratorium for a week until we can figure out how to make chickens as clean as Polyface does. But no, they said, well, this isn't all we're interested in. I said, oh, really? What else are you interested in? They said, well, you have to have a bathroom. I said, a
Oh,
bathroom?
dear.
I'm 50 feet. I'm in the backyard. I'm 50 feet from our house. We have two. I'm 70 feet from mom's house. She has two. And if I want to go number one, I just step behind the tractor and go. What are you going to do about that? I mean that, and so we got to have bathrooms. I said, well, what else do we have to have? So, well, you have to have changing lockers for your employees. I said,
What in the
we don't
world?
have any employees. I said, you have to have a minimum of nine changing lockers for your employees. I said, we don't even have any employees. And guys, it goes on like this. I mean, this just goes on and on and on.
Ridiculous.
It is. It's completely ridiculous. And so they couldn't. Here they were seeing the cleanest chicken they'd ever seen in their lives, I'm sure. And they had a lab report to prove it. And it was as if it didn't even exist. They weren't interested in that. All they were interested in was demanding concrete, stainless steel, light bulbs, buildings, walls, all this stuff, and which has nothing to do. I looked at them and I said, listen, I said, really, all we want here, isn't it, is clean chicken? And if I can gut a chicken in the kitchen sink and it's as clean as what's in the store, who cares if I gut it in a kitchen sink? Who
Yeah,
cares if I put
exactly.
it on a wooden table? Who cares where it is? But those kind of things, and I document a lot of these old stories we've had in my book, Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal, because that's the way this shakes down. Is you when once you start analyzing it, you just realize how the absurdity of this. And yet the average person on the street, they just think these government agencies are their protection between them and death. And that's the shame. That's a shame.
Yeah, and the reality is just like you were saying, when you actually have real scientific data that proves the case that there's this guise that they're operating under, you find out that the real agenda actually has nothing to do with the entire premise of their existence. It has everything to do with just creating a greater burden or a greater prohibition for you to participate in the market. And
It's like it's when we had we've had a couple big showdowns, and the biggest one, we had the state, the head of the state inspection, and his federal whatever compatriot, and we had our delegate, our state delegate's legislative assistant here. He was busy. He couldn't get here, but he sent her. And between you and me and the fence post, a lot of times the head legislative assistant for elected politicians is actually smarter than the politician. The politician is a good, speaker, and they're, good press the flesh. But a lot of them, the smartest people are actually on their staff, and a good one will, get good people. Anyway, so she's sitting there. She's a really classy, 55-year-old lady with, half moon glasses, and she pulls them down on her nose, and she looks up at these two bureaucrats. She says, "Gentlemen," after a half hour back and forth, and she says, "Gentlemen, is it possible that these regulations were created by some bureaucrat sitting in a government office somewhere who could never have conceived of an operation like what Joel is running here?" And boy, she just nailed it. She just nailed it. That's why I'm actually gentler. I'm actually gentler on the bureaucrats than I am on the duplicitous consumers who demand the bureaucrats, because the bureaucrats, they're just doing what the legislature has entrusted them to do. "We want you to make sure nobody ever gets sick from a, gets sick from a bad chicken." All right. So they sit there in their cubicles. "Well, what would it take to make a clean chicken?" "Well, you need this temperature water. You need this amount of antimicrobials. You need this kind of table. You need this kind of floor. You need this kind of drainage system," and da, 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 all this stuff. And the fact is, you don't need any of that to make a clean chicken. But they're thinking in terms of Tyson, Purdue, Cargill, and they're creating a structure that a non-thinking, non-caring person couldn't help but have a safe chicken come through it. Well, we care, we think, we observe. We don't need $1 million worth of infrastructure surrounding every chicken. All we need to do is care. And if we care, we're okay. But of course, most of these big companies are populated, their workforce doesn't care. They're just, in fact, they want to get out of it as soon as they can. And so they're, every waking moment they're conspiring on, "How can I get out of this place?" I mean, the turnover is whatever, like 40% or some such thing. It's crazy. And so it's a different world. And so I yeah the problem is that we need a place. When the other side says, "Well, we need a level playing field. It's not fair for us to give you concessions and not that we can't give to Tyson. So we need a level playing field. That all these regulations, this is to level the playing field." You know what that's like, guys? That's like saying we're going to level the playing field on football. We're going to level the playing field on football so we're gonna criminalize any football game that's not played in an NFL stadium and refereed by licensed NFL referees. So you can't play in your backyard. You can't have the lilac bush and the peach tree as your goal, as your goal posts. You can't play with six players. You have to have 11, and you can't play with 12. You got to only have 11. If that were the case, where would be the innovation, the creativity, and the skill set coming in to the NFL? Well, it comes from pickup backyard ball games that kids play when they're 6 and 7 and 8 years old. That's where the cream starts to rise. And so in food, it's the same situation. Leveling the playing field by precluding participation from all the little innovative upstarts guarantees that you will only have the orthodox narrative and whatever the status quo protocols perpetuated ad nauseum into infinity, when actually we've shown you can have clean chicken, you can have safe food without a bunch of toxic chemistry. You can do this. And so preserving the chance, preserving the opportunity of embryonic prototypes to access the market is absolutely the key to not only preserving competitive authenticity within the marketplace, but it's the only way that you can guarantee that tomorrow's food will benefit from today's innovation.
Yeah, and you've also proven that you can do it in a profitable fashion and that it's scalable. And this is one idea that I wanted to bring up and get kind of your ideas or feedback on it. Regenerative farming must be legacy based to work and to scale long term. And I think you're an example of that. We now see the next generation that's kind of taking over and advancing. But if we're going to practice these regenerative principles and we're taking this old property with terrible soil and we're doing this process, that process isn't an instant process and it takes time. But if it's done properly, right, it exponentially improves. And in theory, that next generation, if taught and participating properly, it should continue to exponentially expand. So if regenerative agriculture is a solution to our supply chain issues, it must in some way, and in your case and in our case, we want it to be our offspring, and Lord willing, it'll be our offspring taking it again to the next level. But even if let's say you don't have any children, if it's that one key man employee or whatever, it should or needs to be designed in a legacy type format in order for us to be able to resolve this supply chain issue.
You are so right, and I think you said it well, and I appreciate you offering grace to the family who maybe either doesn't have children or doesn't have children that are interested. Not all kids want to be farmers, and we parents need to be careful not to, not to present our children with a love that's conditioned on them doing what we want them to do. That's not a way to have, children with good self-worth and an affirming psyche. And so, yeah, you're exactly right. The way, throughout history, the way tribes developed wealth was by leveraging elder, and that's both patriarchal and matriarchal, elder wisdom on youthful energy. As you age, your energy level wanes, but your experience increases. And so, it in a, in a snowstorm, for example, here's the old, patriarch sitting back there. He's 70. He says, "Yeah, I remember back in 67 when we had that blizzard and the cows went out over that hill, and it was warm back over there, and he remembers where the cows wanted to be, but he doesn't take them out there. He sends the young generation out there to take the herd to that backside of that hill where, it was protected from the blizzard and where he remembers that they wintered that blizzard just fine. But that historically, that's how families and tribes developed wealth, was by revering the experiential wisdom of the older generation, but leveraging that on youthful energy. The problem we have right now in American agriculture is that the average farmer is now 60 years old. And in the next 15 years, that's 1-5, 15 years, half of all America's agriculture equity, that's land, buildings, and equipment, half of it is going to change hands to the next generation. And so the big question is, where is that next generation? Who is it? Where is it? What's going to happen? Is Bill Gates going to buy it all? Are the Chinese going to buy it all? Is BlackRock going to buy it all? Where does that go? And so, yeah, I'm a big believer that to have one of the key elements of a sustainable farm is that it produces two salaries from two different generations. Now, they can be related or unrelated, it doesn't matter. But having two salaries from two different generations is the minimal requirement for having an authentic business that is attractive to the next generation. We just had the Stockman grass farmer gathering here at the farm back in August, and one of our speakers was Kit Farrow of Farrow Cattle Company. He's the largest grass-based seed stock producer in the world. He has, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 cows. He's across something like 13 states. It's a massive operation, all grass-based, no grain, and he sells bulls, and well, he sells heifers too. But anyway, he asked the crowd. It was such a it was just one of those. I'm repeating the story because he's the first person I've ever heard say this, but it was so profound that I'm realizing how right he was. He said, he asked the group, and he said, "So why aren't young people taking over their parents' farms? Why do we have this glitch in farm succession?" And of course, people said, "Well, they don't want to." The common thing is, "Well, they don't want to work that hard. There's not enough money in it," or any number of things. And so he let all these regular things come out, And then he gave his profound blockbuster. He said, "The reason is the off-farm job." He said, when you run your farm from an off-farm job mentality, you run it like a hobby. And kids don't want to inherit hobbies. They want to inherit businesses. And kids are smart enough to know whether this is actually a credible business or if it's a hobby. And his challenge was not, everybody quit your off-farm job. His challenge was, if you aspire to have a legacy farm, and I love the word legacy farm, if you aspire to have a legacy farm, you have to have the mentality of a business. It has to be a standalone. You can't run it like a hobby. You can't pick up all your mistakes with off-farm income. You've got to run this thing as a credible business. And then the next generation, whether they're related or unrelated, you'll be able to find somebody that wants to come in as a partner with you as you age, because it'll actually be a credible business. And you will be thinking like a business. You won't be thinking like a hobby. You'll be thinking like a business. And I just thought that was just a profound insight into this whole legacy successional element that we're dealing with in our country. In our own family, of course, I'm second generation here. Dad and mom bought the farm, and they never made a living from the farm. Mom was a school teacher, dad was an accountant, and the off-farm jobs paid for the farm. So I'm coming along. It's finally paid for by the time I'm, late in high school, and I'm really wanting to farm full time. I never saw mom and dad do it, but they did a lot of experimenting. And we felt like we had a handle on something that would work. And I'm sitting here, how do I do this? And so, then I'm in college, and now I get out, and this is, the 1970s, and Teresa and I got married, and we fixed up the attic in the we fixed up the attic as an apartment in an old farmhouse. We called it our penthouse, not an attic. And we lived on about $300 a month. We drove a $50 car, took our honeymoon in a $50 car. And just, if we didn't grow it in the garden, we didn't eat it. We had a couple milk cows. We had our own firewood. We had our own garden. We had our own eggs. So we basically, lived on nothing. And we were able to save up enough money in 2 years that we could live for 1 year without the outside paycheck. So September 24, 1982, I walked out, came home full time. I didn't think we would make it. I honestly didn't think we would make it. But what I thought was, if I can be home for a year, we'll make so much progress that maybe my time away can be cut from, 15 years to 12, or 12 to 8, or 8 to, whatever. And as it turned out, that little widow's cruise of oil, if you will, kept hanging in there. And it by the third year we were able to exhale and realize, I think we're going to make it at 3 years. But that little nest egg, we just stretched and stretched and stretched, and we were able to make it. And so I'm testimony, I think, to the power. And we were hungry. We didn't have Swiss bank accounts. We didn't have any fallback plan. It was all in or nothing. And boy, when you're hungry, you get really, really creative. And that creativity, pushed us to do things that other people wouldn't have done, or wouldn't do. And we didn't have a front end loader. We didn't have a four wheeler. We walked. We rented. We had good neighbors. We built relationships with the neighbors, and they had front end loaders, and so we'd hire them to come down and do things. We worked a relationship with a neighbor that had a ba hay baler. We didn't have a hay baler. We shared a hay baler with him. He worked in a factory, but since I was home, I could go rake his hay, so we could make it when he got home from his job. And then he let me use the baler when Teresa and I would bale hay when he was at work. And you work out these trades and these relational things, and suddenly you'd be surprised how cheaply you can get a get your leg in the door. It's quite amazing. But it comes from not thinking of it as a lifestyle, not thinking of it as a hobby. Let's think of this as a business. Yes, lifestyle is great. Office is great. I love to go out, and see the beauty in the morning, and watch the birds and the butterflies and all that. But at the end of the day, it has to be profitable. It has to make sense as a business. And we were forced into that because we didn't have a fallback plan.
I think there's another very powerful idea, regarding your parents. You mentioned your parents, they weren't farmers. They had these off-farm jobs, but you know what they did do? When it was your turn to farm, the farm was paid for, and when you think about this legacy idea, and some people, we have to think long term. And what we did is when we moved, I was originally in the financial planning field, and I became there was things I saw in that field that made me completely question modern monetary theory, modern investment theory, all of these synthetic investment vehicles. And in 2008, I completely withdrew everything out of the market, and I haven't participated in the stocks and the bonds since 2008. And, but we developed this idea: what if we could develop a legacy in real time, not an insurance policy, and when we croak, our children just get money, right? But what if we could create a living legacy? And what if that looked like, okay, we can acquire dirt, right? And we can acquire dirt and we can develop that together as a family. So the boys and our little girl, you know, they can participate in that process, develop it, whether it's cutting down trees, clearing land, burning brush piles and all these things. And if we can do this live in real time in our lifetime, then that land will be available for our children, right? So my son, he's 19, and as we speak, he's building his house on the property next door, which we purchased last year. And this is such a powerful idea. What if, okay, oh, you know, we go to these conferences all the time and we have local meetups, right? And oh, I want to do this. I want to do this homestead thing. Oh, I want to farm, right? And I want to know my food and all these things. And but it's just like financially, right? Like it took me 47 years to get where I'm at financially. And when I was 27, you know, I just, and because of that generational mindset, like, oh, I want to be where the 47-year-old guy is. You know what I mean? And I want to drive a Ferrari and have $1 million in the bank and all this kind of dumb stuff. And you know, but the thing that people have to keep in mind is you can't do it overnight. Think long term, block out the noise, you know, and that was that powerful asset that your parents gave you was the property.
Yeah, I stand on the shoulders of greatness of two generations that lived below their means instead of above their means. And too many American families are living a bit above their means. And you can never actually generate wealth that way. You can never get ahead. You're always going to be behind. And the other thing that mom and dad did that I'm always grateful for is that they were not afraid to be mavericks. They were not afraid to be different. Our house embraced being different. Let me give you one story. So dad was in his late 50s. As I say, he was an accountant. He was not a CPA, but he did prepare taxes and did bookkeeping. In his late 50s, he was the head financial officer for a small, you know, sole proprietorship in the area. Had about I don't know, 15, 16 employees. It was a metal fabrication outfit. They did, you know, stainless steel conveyor belts and all sorts of things. Metal fabrication shop, and he was the, you know, he ran the office. You know, he did all the bidding and the drawings and the estimating, you know, supplies, payroll, all that stuff. So it's 1970, whatever, 1974, the Arab oil embargo. You guys are too young to remember that probably, but when Jimmy Carter was president, the Arabs embargoed oil, and we couldn't get oil, and in the U.S. They did a Carter did a thing where you could only buy gasoline on, if your license tag was an even number, you could buy it on an even numbered day. And if it was an odd number, you could buy it on an odd numbered day. So if you needed gas and you had an even numbered license tag
What?
and it was an odd day, you couldn't get gas. And you know, yeah, you young people, you don't realize all this background. Okay, so against this background, it was a huge thing. You can look it up.
Huh.
All right, so dad's in his late 50s. This metal fabrication shop is 17 miles from our house to the, you know, to the off to the shop where he worked. He went out and bought a 10-speed bicycle and started riding his bicycle 17 miles one way to work in his late 50s. In his late 50s,
Wow.
one way to work
Oh,
and
man.
home. And he just said, just as nonchalantly as possible, you know what? If everybody do this, the Arabs can just keep their oil in the ground and we won't suffer at all. And he was exactly right. But I mean,
Yeah.
for us kids, what that, you know, why do you have kids? Well, so they can roll their eyes at you, right? And so, you know, we rolled our eyes. But as I've gotten older, and I remember when I hit my late 50s, I'm thinking, man, would I go get a 10-speed bicycle and ride 17 miles one way to work? You know, just to prove a point, just to say, I'm not going to participate. But that was the house I grew up in. And I'm so grateful that they didn't care what other people said. We were not peer dependent. We embraced being different that way, and it was, you know, such a blessing to be able to have that. And which leads me to that notion, when you talk about, the Ferrari and the, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, right? Those are the besetting sins. And they describe the average person's goal, right? Objective is lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Pride of life being, things, mansions and Ferraris and all this stuff. And it begs the question, what is wealth? What is real wealth? And we have an incredibly skewed idea of what real wealth is in this country. And I would suggest, especially in a day in today's time, when there are so many things that seem to be, what should we say, coming off the rails, that the new 401k plan, if you really want a true 401k plan, it means that you live proximate to people in relationship with people who know how to grow things, fix things, and build things. And if if you and your friends know how to fix things, grow things, and build things, that wealth is far higher than stocks and bonds, even gold and silver. You can't eat gold and you can't eat silver. And it's really hard to get it to burn enough to keep you warm in the winter. Knowing how to fix a chainsaw, run a chainsaw, build a fire, butcher a chicken, grow a tomato plant, can fruit, grow a tree, prune a tree, prune a grapevine. Those are true skills that are authentic and full of wealth. And so I think that there's a we have missed in our country, we have missed a deep appreciation of non-monetary wealth, how valuable it is, and how to acquire it.
Yeah, and two things. One, I appreciated what you said about your parents being different and authentic. We have a saying around here, observe the masses and do the opposite, right? Which is the principle that your dad was teaching you is, form. And if it's going to allow you to succeed, if it's going to build character, if it's going to make a way for you, embrace the weird, observe the masses, and do the opposite. Secondarily, what you're mentioning about these worldly possessions, the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, the Ferraris and different things. Not only do people have a wrong understanding of wealth, our country has a completely false paradigm of capital or capitalism, right? We are in a completely and utterly not just a debt-based economy, but a hyper debt-based economy that is insurmountable from any type of natural means of however that's all going to work. But I mean, capital was what? Savings, right? Capital was savings, and capitalism was the injection of capital or the leveraging or use of capital.
That
And
investment.
this is why people want to know, oh, how did BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, how did they take over the world? Well, we gave them all of our money is how. Oh, well, because of hyperinflation, I need an 8 to 12% rate of return. The only place I can get that rate of return is in the stock market, right? So we outsource all of our wealth. We've outsourced all of our strategy. And then for some trinket, some government trinket of like tax deferred status, right? We allow them to abscond it for our lifetime. So we have no leverage. We have no way to implement our capital because we hide it in some supposed tax shelter. And we assume, and all the smart financial planners tell us that, well, when you retire, somehow your tax rate is going to be lower than right now because somehow taxes are going to go down. Well, I've been alive 47 years, and for the last 47 years, I've watched taxes go up. And so, we do have.
Let me tell you, I'm 20 years older, and it'll still be the same way in 20 years. Trust me, not gonna happen. And do you mean to actually tell me that modern monetary theory doesn't work? I thought that was the, I thought being overspending by $2 trillion in 1 year was a way to solve all the problems. I thought economics only that only works for individuals, but governments they're immune to the principles of economics. Henry Hazlitt and Milton Friedman, all they sound good for you and me, but when it comes to the government, they don't have to abide by any of these economic principles.
Yeah, except for I thought it was of, by, and for the people, right? Like it, because look, they do the same thing because, they, them, and those, and the government, the pejorative, but it's made like these district of criminals and these swamp creatures that do all this stuff to us, they're people too. And so it's, but they like to create this, largesse of a word government, and the government gets a pass, and it can break every rule. And meanwhile, us plebs down here, we have to be good taxpayers.
We did. Well, we live in a time of where it's hip to defund something. We're gonna defund investing in Israel. We're gonna defund the police. We're gonna defund this. Well, you know what? I got news for you. It's time to defund the government. And so
Amen.
let's all figure out how to live on less, so we pay fewer taxes, and have our, if there's one reason to have a business, an LLC, it's so you can live your life with pre-tax dollars. So, I don't own a car, I don't own a phone, I don't own my laptop. The business owns all that, and so I can expense all that off as pre-tax dollars. And so, in actuality, most of our lives, Teresa and I have actually lived under the cash poverty line. In America, we've lived under that cash poverty line, which means our taxes are extremely low. But how do we do it? Well, if we don't have to buy a car personally, don't have to buy a laptop personally, don't have to do the utilities personally, if we don't have any of that, you don't need much actual cash, personal cash, to live on. And so you drop that way down with your LLC, and the LLC then bleeds off its income to show very little profit, by bleeding off its income to your necessary business expenses. And you don't take very much income, and suddenly you defund the government. And if everybody did that, we'd have a different climate. That
Yeah, and you know what?
would be climate change we can all get behind.
Yeah, that's right. You know what else you're doing is by trickling money to yourself personally, you are war chesting your revenue and your wealth in your farm, which is then going to pass forward, if it's established properly, it's going to pass forward in a untaxable or a less taxable format. And that is a well strategy, and it's not sexy and there isn't a pie chart and you can't demonstrate a 8% year-over-year rate of return and all these different things, but you have a mitigation tax strategy and you are war chesting your real world wealth in infrastructure and in real stuff. I mean, I think we can't overemphasize, like, everybody's like Meta and VR and augmented reality and, high rise living. And we really have to return to the real stuff, dirt and dirty fingernails and all these different things. And these are solutions. Like these are the way to solve the problems.
Yeah, for example, great point on, for example, on our farm, over the years, and this has taken, years to develop, but we now have 12 miles of buried inch and a quarter water line around all, yeah, 12 miles around
12
our fields
miles.
that are fed by ponds that we've built up in high valleys that give us 70-pound pressure water, gravity, no pumps, no electricity, with millions of gallons stored in these excavated a labyrinth of ponds that tie together to give us millions of gallons of water across the farm with no electricity, nothing. And that is, the interesting thing is visitors, nobody sees it, because they're buried water lines. Nobody goes up to the mountain to see the ponds, so nobody sees any of this stuff. But from a long-term legacy, whatever, resilience standpoint, goodness gracious. I mean, even if the power goes off, if a hurricane comes through, if we've got water, and so, these are the kinds of things that when you're completely oriented to developing a piece of land into a legacy wealth fund, those are the kind of things. You develop the commons, you develop the soil, you develop the water, you develop the biodiversity, you develop the wildlife runs, and all of these things. You develop all this, and then it can be carried forward. Unfortunately, the IRS doesn't tax ponds. It doesn't tax earthworms. It doesn't tax compost. It doesn't tax any of this stuff. And so if we convert our woods from a forest fire risky situation, and convert that to thinning out, taking out the junk trees, taking out the dead stuff, upgrading kind of what we call weeding the woodlot so it's not conducive to a fire at all, the IRS doesn't even recognize that as a value. But you and I know that that is a huge value going forward. And the remaining trees end up, they grow better, and so future generations will have more lumber, more, so we can actually have fewer trees, grow more lumber, and mitigate fire risk, all without the IRS even taking a notice of it. That's pretty cool.
That is awesome. And then maybe in closing, we could talk about the Rogue Food Conference that's going to be going on in Dallas.
Yes. The Rogue Food Conference in Dallas, November 9. And so our whole moniker there is circumvention, not compliance. There comes a time when government, especially federal government, overreach, or I will say tyranny, becomes so strong that rather than th that it's actually more efficient, more efficacious to circumvent the rules rather than try to comply with the rules. And so we started this back in 2020 in the spring, early spring in February of 2020. And we do two of them a year around the country, different ones. The next one's gonna be in Dallas, November 9, and then one in Florida next spring, and then one in Ohio next fall. And the whole idea is to showcase people who have successfully made an end run around these onerous requirements that we've been talking about. And there is some real creativity out there, from food churches to private membership associations to constitutional arguments to renting a square foot and butchering somebody's cow on their own rental square foot. So now, it's actually on their land and not yours. I mean, there's all sorts of real, to labeling food as pet food, not for human consumption. I mean, there's all sorts of things. And so we've been doing this now for 4 years, and there are more and more people who are some people hybridize, some people, take these ideas and run a little farther with them. But the point is, we're putting on stage people who have not bowed, who have not bowed and said, we're going to stand and figure something out. And so Where we are right now is if you can't outsmart a bureaucrat, then shame on you, you know. And
Good point.
they're some of the most uncreative people in the world. And so we if you ever
Yep.
want to come to a day where at the end of the day you feel like you have just drunk out of a freedom fire hose for the day, the Rogue Freedom Conference is a place to come. We're going rogue. We stand proudly on going rogue because we think the nation is going the wrong way, and so we're
Yeah.
gonna go rogue, go a whole different way, and support and encourage folks who are doing it and who would like to do it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so we've mentioned a lot of issues and different things, and the reason I wanted to bring up the Rogue Food Conference is these are people implementing the solutions to
Yeah.
these issues
Yes.
and this bureaucracy. And there will be a link down below. If you're interested in the Rogue Food Conference, there will be a link down below. And so we have a lot of things going on,
A lot.
and recent developments, like my son's getting married and different things.
Ah,
So
heck yeah.
we wanted to come. I'm going to try to come, but I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to pull that off or not.
Yeah.
But Joe, man, we really appreciate you coming on. We've learned so much from the information that you've put out over the years and the inspiration and the demonstration. Like, look, it's possible. I'm doing it. Here's how I do it. You can do it too. And that type of influence, and when you talk about wealth, right? When you develop that kind of influence to inspire people, that number, there's no number that can be put, and that is non-taxable as well. There's no number that can be put on that. And I just want to say from my family and from the next generation that we appreciate the effort and the hard work and the parhesia and the eloquence, and the anecdotals and the stories and all these different things. And you are, in my opinion, a master storyteller. We appreciate you and we thank you for coming on. Is there any, in closing, is there anything that you want to leave the audience with?
Well, the only thing that I like to leave the audience with is the idea that your decisions matter. So many of these things, they seem so big that, you know, what can I do about the war in Ukraine? What can I do about, you know, I mean, they just seem, you know, they're intimidatingly large, right? And so we just feel powerless, you know, in the face of whatever it is we don't like. And I would just tell people, just remember where we are today is the physical manifestation of trillions and trillions of decisions that have been made by our forebears up until today. And where we are and the world your grandchildren are going to inherit is going to likewise be the physical manifestation of the decisions that all of us make between now and then. And so every decision you make matters. Every single one you make matters. And don't ever underestimate the power of the cumulative effect of many decisions made correctly. It's what has moved nations. It's what has moved movements. It has changed the course of history. And so don't worry about how many other people share your movement. Don't worry about how many other people share your thoughts. Just stand for what's right. Do what's right. Make your decision for what's right. And there are other people who also have not yet bowed to Baal, and they are looking for you to join us and make 1 + 1 = 3.
Wow, that is excellent. So y'all, remember we are demonetized on YouTube and we are a value for value proposition. If you appreciate this information, support our affiliates down below or go to the texasboys.com. Our new website is up and running. We love and appreciate y'all and appreciate your support. And remember, y'all, stay fearless, my friends.